This is Franz Amason. Welcome back to the Travel Trade Exchange podcast. It's been a while since I've put a podcast on. My last interviews with Eric Hansen were great. I've got some great interviews planned in the future, one with Rolf Potts, who's written several books. Also, there's a traveler named Jenny who has a blog that I've read, and she's traveling in India right now, and I look forward to talking to her when the opportunity arises. We're having a difficult time connecting. She's a volunteer in a nonprofit organization in India right now. The problem I have is when I'm sleeping, she's awake, and when she's awake, I'm sleeping, so there's an 11 and a half hour time difference. So it's been a while. Also, my regular day job does take up a lot of my time, and we're right in the middle of the ski season here in Utah, and I like to go skiing. And I'm doing this for fun, so don't expect them to be on a regular basis. They will come out when I can do it. I encourage you, if you want to hear more stories, you need to contribute your own stories as well. I can't keep doing this without some contributions from our listeners. And I expect you to call in and give some of your own travel stories, either in an audio format or the call-in line. Just go to our website, www.traveltradeexchange.com. Join, submit your own audio file, or use the call-in line to leave a story, or submit a written story. If you want to do an interview, leave me a note, and I will call you up and interview. I like to do interviews. So with that, let's get on to today's show. I had a great call last week. A friend of mine, Bill Wiebe, who did a podcast with me on his travels down the Amazon when he was trying to take a car down to South America, or when he took a car down to South America. I think that was podcast 3 or podcast 4. Well, he called me up. He happened to be in town. He wanted to get together and talk. And I said, well, geez, come on down. I'll grab a beer. We'll sit down and we'll tell me some more of your stories. So I got him to come down to my office and talk for a while. And he talks about a lot of the time he spent in Ecuador and some of his other travel adventures. So with no more ado, let's get on with that interview. I'm talking to my friend Bill Wiebe, the great traveler, an old friend of mine, and we're going to talk about a few of Bill's stories along the way. Bill, how old are you now?
I'm 58 right now, just 58 and still hanging in there, I guess.
When did you start traveling?
Let's see, my dad, first jet plane I was ever on was in 1964. My dad took us to Europe on a sabbatical. He spent a year in Germany, and that was the first time I'd ever really traveled at all. First time I'd been on a jet. First time I'd been to Germany. First time I'd been in a German school. So that was kind of an introduction. It was like he just threw me in. It was like no messing around. We just went for the full treatment.
How old were you again?
I was 11 years old.
And you learned a bit of German, because I remember as kids you used to speak German quite a bit.
Well, that was his plan, was we were supposed to be fluent in German by the time I got back. And my sister actually did. She got pretty good at it. But I was not nearly as talkative as she was. And the class I was in was in the gymnasium, was in the German. They divide the kids up when they're 10 years old, and they sort of put them in a technical school, or a Volksschule, they call it, sort of the basic school, or else they put you into this gymnasium, which was sort of headed for a university or what have you. And it was remarkable. The German foreign language programs, the teachers that taught English, were pretty darn good at it. And a lot of those kids knew English better than I knew German, and it kind of stayed that way. I had a crutch that my sister didn't, so I didn't get nearly as good at speaking German as she did. But I got to the point where I could get around and, you know, do the basics. It just wasn't real fluent, and it wasn't real conversational at that point. So that was the first travel I ever did. We came back from Germany, and I didn't really leave the United States till I got out of high school, I suppose. And I've been traveling one way or another ever since. It sort of works with the job I have. I've got this fishing job up in Alaska, and the beautiful thing about most Alaska jobs is that they end. They're seasonal. They start early in the spring, and they often end, my job ends by September, and so I have this this time off during the winter, and there's no better thing to do in Alaska than get out of there for part of the time during the winter. So that's what I've been doing pretty much ever since, and we've been all over. I've never gone around the world, but we've been all over the place. Recently, during the last 10 years, I've been trying to learn Spanish, and we've been spending a lot of time in South America and Central America during the last 10 years. A little bit of time in Honduras, and I worked in an orphanage there, and then I took a car trip across the length of South America. And then in 2005, we took my son to Quito, Ecuador, and lived there for the school year. And Quito's a pretty remarkable place. It's a very cosmopolitan city. There's people from all over the planet that live there. Part of it's a capital, so we have the diplomatic section of town. And part of it's a, oh, there's the oil companies that are there. And seems like it's quite different from the rest of Ecuador. It's a very urban place. The balance of Ecuador can be, well, except for Guayaquil, I suppose, is a very poor farming economy. But Quito itself is kind of a lively place. It's got a great climate and good restaurants and just a nice place to live. We went there kind of on a whim. I was kind of angling to get my son into a Spanish-speaking school, and my wife finally came around to the idea, sort of. But then she found this international British school in Quito, and that sort of sealed the deal. We weren't going to go to any dirt floor type of school in the countryside. We were going to go to this little bit fancier place in Quito. So it was like an urban experience, a little different than what I had anticipated, but very cool in its own way. I loved this urban scene. It wasn't like anything that I'd been living into up to then. I'd live in Logan, Utah, and I grew up, and then in Alaska after that. So it was quite different.
So was it a large city then?
Yeah, Quito is the largest. It's the second largest city in Ecuador. Probably a couple million people. I'm not quite sure on that, but the big place and the capital of the country. Lots of politics going on there. Lots of presidents getting replaced there by sort of on-the-street democracy. Like if they don't like the president, they basically throw him out, sometimes physically. Just before we got there, there was a very conservative, very upright sort of Spanish president that got caught with his fingers in the oil money, a little bit of corruption going on there. That's not unusual. It's kind of the way the country operated. But for some reason, they got mad at Lucio, and the people took to the streets, and they started chanting. It was, Fuera Lucio, Fuera Lucio. And it built, and the whole town started marching on the presidential palace on Plaza Grande. This is before we were there.
Okay.
But only a year after we were there.
Okay.
It sort of illustrates the way the democracy worked down there. It wasn't like you really stood much chance of going through your entire presidential term. For some reason or another, you'd have to resign or you'd get thrown out. And this Lucio guy, they climbed the walls of the presidential palace, draped in the Ecuadorian flag, and he managed to escape by getting into a limo out the back door, driving to the airport with the crowd following him, telling him to get out of the country. So there was this procession to the international airport, which is only, oh, I don't know, 3-4 miles from the presidential palace. And he flew away to Colombia, and that was the last we heard of him for a while. And while we were there, it was uncertain who the president was. I don't really remember. I do know that there were times during that year where you could the tension was so thick in the air, you could just feel it. You'd get close to this Plaza Grande in the middle of Ecuador, where the seat of government is, and there would be riot police and different sort of, you know, the paddy wagons to haul people away, and you get this whiff of tear gas on occasion. And I went down there one day where all the people were walking rapidly my direction while I was going towards the Plaza Grande, and I soon realized the reason for that was that they just gassed the whole place, and the fumes from this tear gas was just finally vanishing. So it was kind of interesting the way things happened down there politically.
How many times did you go back to Ecuador?
I've been there, well, I don't know, two or three times. This time I'm talking about was about 8 months, and we stayed there. I stayed there for six. I flew back to go herring fishing in Alaska, and then I flew back down there for a little bit because my family was still there. So it was about 8 months all told. We've been there a couple of times, but this is, living in the city was where I really got a taste of this whole sort of the urban scene, an urban, fairly wealthy scene, actually, in the middle of South America.
So you were in the good side of town then?
Well, we started out in, we just landed there. We didn't know anybody. We knew we were going to go to this, that my kid was going to this school, the British school in Quito. I knew he was going to go there. But we didn't have any place to stay. And my wife, she's kind of remarkable. She kept running and doing her exercise around town. And first thing she noticed there was this house with a for rent sign on it. And it was being rented by an Ecuadorian who, of all things, had married a Canadian 20 years ago. And she had gone to someplace in, outside of Ontario with her new husband, who owned a farm up there in Toronto. And they had three kids, and everything was going along fine until he got killed in a car crash. It was kind of a sad thing. She ended up with three young children and no husband. And really no connection for Canada at all. You know, it was a guy she had met on the beach and married, and she was the new bride from Ecuador. So everybody, things kind of went her way, and they sold the farm, and she ended up with quite a little pile of money, but no job, no career, some family connections back in Quito. And that was about it. So she moved back to Ecuador and bought a house with these proceeds because she said she couldn't trust anything else. So she bought a very nice house with a lot of the money that she had gotten on this.
So she felt that would retain its value where the currency might not retain its value.
Yeah, and she was right. I mean, okay. The currency, it eventually ended up being the U.S. dollar, but not before a lot of people lost their life savings by using the banking system down there. It was a very corrupt, poorly run. Their currency didn't, it inflated or else one way or another. And finally, a number of years before we got there, they replaced it with the U.S. dollar. And she said she lost about $15,000 in the bank, which was, she thought that was very fortunate.
That was an acceptable loss in that situation.
She was lucky not to have got pegged with a whole lot worse than that. So she bought this house, and she was a single lady, and she turned out to be an empty nester. By the time we went there, her kids had just moved away from the house, and she didn't have any use for the top, what turned out to be, three floors and a little house up on the top, on the terraza, up on the top of the building. So it was like a vertical, it was like a building, four stories high for one house. And she decided that she wanted to live in the bottom floor and that she'd rent out the top three floors to us. So it had a separate kitchen and it was very nice. It was some architect that obviously spent some time building. It was built around a central spiral staircase of these woods from the tropical hardwood from the Ecuadorian tropics. And it was nice. One thing about hiring labor in Quito is it was cheap and it was pretty good, and you could get some pretty quality work down there. She was actually quite a forceful personality, as I came to find out to my chagrin, But
sounds like a story, Bill.
Well, that's how I'm going to end the story. Is what Mildred was her name, Mildred. And at first, we had an excellent relationship. I was paying the rent fairly, well, regularly in advance. I was paying it as our little contract had stated. But she was no businesswoman, and eventually she really needed to get one of her kids to take over her affairs because she had no head for it at all. She did manage, I guess I shouldn't say that, because she did manage to save this settlement from Canada, and she was not just running a flower shop someplace. She managed to live, subsist on at a fairly high lifestyle in Quito on this settlement from Canada. So things must have gone fairly well for her. In any event, Jane was running past this house and sees that the top three floors are for rent. And what do you know, Mildred knows how to speak English, and her son happened to be there, and he was fluent in English. So Jane took one look at the house, and she loved it, and it was two or three times as much rent as I really thought we should pay.
And what did you think you should pay, Bill?
I figured $300 a month was going to be plenty, and we ended up, Mildred, I don't know why I said she wasn't a good business, didn't have a head for business, but she eventually got $900 out of us for this 8-month lease. So we proceeded to move into the urban scene in Quito. We took our kid to the British school, and he was soon riding the little yellow school bus every morning off to the British school to get an international education rather than the Spanish that I thought he should have been learning. So it was a wonderful place. We ended up, I just loved walking around that city, and everything happened right on the street, you know, right on the street front, nothing behind, you know, that they're always trying to sell you something. So you'd go to a street that might be Sunglasses Street, and then another one would be where you get your brakes fixed, and another one would have all the glass shops in town. So they sort of seemed to gather up sort of by the guild or by the trade that they were. And certain parts of town were very wealthy. The diplomatic district had all the embassies and the consulates, and that was pretty wealthy. And there were some foreign companies just to the north of the old city. The old city is one of those World Heritage sites. It's been there since, I don't know, it's for a long time, but it's a very colonial, beautiful city. But it's a little older, and the richer part of towns were to the north and towards the airport. So we had, that's where we were. We ended up in a place called Gaspar de Villarroel. And we ended up taking the top three floors of this house and then proceeded to invite anybody that felt like coming to come down and visit us. So we had my mom, and we had my uncle that came down, and his daughters, and we had, three or four families from Homer that came down over the course of the year. Usually in the middle of winter, it got kind of busy. It was one piece of entertaining after another.
What was the climate like?
So the climate varies. They say in Quito that you have all four seasons every day. So usually it starts off quite cool in the morning. You start off with, it would be clear and cool in the morning. And then the sun comes up and it's right on the equator. So it starts to get really hot. So any kind of moisture that's in the air just bakes right out of it. So you think you're going to just sweating your shirt off by the afternoon. But remarkably enough, the clouds come in from the Pacific, from the west, and they roll over the range. Quito's located in a longitudinal north-south valley. So the clouds come over the volcanoes to the west of the city, and then you get these remarkable thunderstorms in the afternoon. And it'll come through, and all of a sudden the temperature drops, and you get this horrendous rainstorms to come through. Not cold, but enough to get you very wet, and puts a nice chill in the air. And then in the evening, those abate, and I guess the evenings are typically quite cool, and the people come out, and it's just a glorious place. They don't have air conditioning, and we had one little fireplace in this in this house that we rented, and no other heat. So it was just the right temperature almost all the time. So kind of nice that way. Save a few bucks on the fuel bill anyway. So let's see, what else should I tell you about this?
Well, now, how did this lady end up getting the best of you, Bill?
So on we went. I just lived my life. We entertained visitors, and I could amuse myself by just walking down a different section, a different street in the town, go for a walk, go for a hike, buy a shirt. The shirt I'm wearing came from Ecuador. It's like a shopping experience.
When was the last time you were there?
That was 2005. I think we went back once.
So the shirt lasts a while then, huh?
Well,
Durable shirts.
Yeah, it's a nice shirt. I got a bunch of them. Shopping for something was a good language lesson, for one thing, and I liked the shirts, so I bought quite a bunch of them. I just get them out when I need them. They were inexpensive and seemed like... This says Christian Dior, but it's definitely not from France. This is something that they put whatever logo they want to on your shirts down there, and nothing, no patent law, no intellectual property. It was all just a free-for-all. So anyway, Mildred collects the rent every month, and we paid with a... check on a U.S. bank. We'd pay three weeks in advance, and then the check would come through, and we'd pay the rent. So I give Mildred the check.
So you're paying her in U.S. dollars?
Yeah.
On a dollar bank account.
On a bank account in the U.S.
In the U.S. Okay. So you're just writing a basic check to her, then.
Yeah, I write her a basic check. It's a bit of a hassle for Mildred because she has to go to her bank.
Convert it to the local currency.
And wait for it to clear.
Okay.
And that, for some, well, the bank just held on to the money is what they were doing. But finally she'd get it, and so the rent would come through. But the sly little fox, Mildred, that she was, she got a deposit out of me that was twice what it should have been. So I paid $1,800 in a deposit that she was, cross your heart and hope to die that I was going to get this back. The idea being that I was going to use the last 900 for the last month's rent. And Mildred kind of outfoxed me a little bit. She got some money. I came home to fish herring, and she collected an extra month's rent from Jane.
Okay.
So now I had to get $1,800 out of her at the end of the period there. And $1,800 was a lot of money. Well, it's a lot of money to me, but it was a way lot of money to Mildred, and she didn't have much. She wanted the money a lot more than she wanted a continuing relationship with us. So we got into it, and I wanted my money back, and she starts looking at, you know, the house was, I don't know, it had to have been 30 years old, and so there was some, she'd had problems before. I guess I should go into this. She rented the top three floors to some Chinese from a corporation, and that ended badly. She told me how bad she hated Chinese and that nothing was good with that. But that rental thing ended badly. There were, as I discovered later, there were some bullet holes in the glass in the windows. Like, this would be like something that you'd shoot a 20. I looked at them, and I didn't think much. I thought maybe it was gravel at first. But then, no, they were all the same. And they were either a 22 or maybe a pellet gun or a BB gun. I'm not sure
Small holes in.
Yeah, you'd hit the glass and it'd be like the size of a quarter.
Okay.
And the glass would be in, would expand and blow into the inside of the house. And so it'd be this little hole. So there were, I don't know, three or four of these bullet holes. And remarkably enough, they were all the same caliber. And they came from three different sides of the building. So somebody, they don't typically shoot your apartment house, but for some reason these windows had been shot at on purpose from three different sides of the house. So Mildred had a past. And at the end of this deal, I wanted to get my money back, and you could see that she wasn't going to do it, and I kind of got a little hot. And to just the coup de grace is I left my wallet sitting on the kitchen table during this interaction, and by golly, I lost it. And I think I know right where it went. I think it went right down her blouse. And to this day, I have not seen my wallet or the $200 that was inside it. And I had to cancel my visa cards, get a new driver's license, get out of the country. It ended badly, as I say. So Mildred got the best of me on that one. She did cough up. She did give us, I think she felt bad or something, but she gave us about $900. She gave us some money back. I don't recall how much it was, but it was definitely a losing proposition. And if you ever go to South America and rent a place, what you want to do is you want to be very careful about how much you negotiate for a deposit, and just assume that you're not going to give it back. Just assume that you're not going to get it back. Consider it part of the rent. Don't tell your landlady that, but don't even try to collect it, because you're a gringo, you're leaving the country, you have no recourse to get your deposit back. It's you're lucky if you get it. It's the way I look at it.
So when you were in Ecuador, did you how did you fill up your days? You were there for long periods of time.
Yeah, we were there for quite a while. And what I do, I did a fair amount of reading. The internet was one thing I spent. I used to go to town to the Mariscal Sucre in the middle of town. They had a bunch of internet cafes there, real social scene. You'd run into a lot of, there were some Spanish schools down there, and so you'd run into foreign travelers, people from all over the globe, a lot of Europeans, people from all over the place. So a little bit of that, you know, the sort of the cafe life, pick up a copy of a newspaper, try to learn some language, go shopping for some, I took a few classes of Spanish and just had my little verb book with me all the time. So it was, part of the time was trying to learn the language. Part of it was just, I can't say I did anything that was really, amounted to much of a improvement in the state of people or my wealth or anything like that. It was just something I enjoyed doing. So I just spent time walking the streets or visiting.
But you really weren't footloose and fancy free. Your son was down there to go to school, and you couldn't just take off like you used to when you were a younger man.
No, it wasn't like I didn't really want to. You know, we bought a little cheap old car. We bought an old Honda Civic when we got there. But for long periods, I spent the time just this urban scene in Quito was a fine thing. We'd go on trips on the weekends, or we'd take a bus ride down to the beach, or we'd go down. I did a bunch of river running when I was there on the eastern slope into the Amazon jungle. There's some great whitewater there.
So go over the top of the Andes and down the east side of the Andes?
Right.
Which side of the Andes is Quito on, east or west?
Quito would be, it's actually, the drainage is towards the west, but it's in a perched valley that starts off, the lowest end of Quito might be, the north end might be about 8,000 feet, and by the time, it's got to be higher than that, maybe 9,000 feet, and the high southern end might be 10,000 feet high. So it's a very elevated city in this valley at the top of the Andes. It's really has no reason, you know, there's no reason for it to exist, except it's the capital, and the climate is a beautiful thing. The Spaniards that came there realized that. They could get out of the malaria on the coasts and live up high. Recently, the city has gone places because of the, there's an oil pipeline that goes from the jungle to the east. There's a place called Lago Agrio, which means stink lake or sulfur lake, and Texaco discovered a massive oil find there in the 70s, early 70s. They exploited it to the max. There were no environmental regulations, and they left a huge mess. There's lakes out there to this day that are just ponds full of the drilling muds and the oil, the tar that they just left. They just walked away from it. They sold their holdings to Occidental, and they didn't do much better. The Ecuadorians soon realized that they were getting the raw end of the stick. They were selling this resource for a song, and Texaco made a lot of money at it. Occidental did the same thing. They signed certain contracts that would allow them to produce the oil. they paid the Ecuadorian government, or rather the people at the top of the Ecuadorian government, they pay them off, and they built a pipeline to the Pacific coast. And the Ecuadorians, politically smart, they made this 24-inch pipeline go right through Quito. So it goes right through the capital city, And I always think that there must be a valve in there somewhere that the president can turn off if the royalty check doesn't get paid. So while we were there, they had some uprisings on the street that the price of oil was high. They thought, the locals thought correctly, that they were getting screwed, that they were getting the raw end of the stick on this oil royalty thing, and they rejiggered it. They said at first that, well, we're going to split it 50-50 now. They have their own national oil company that took a lot of the holdings, just sort of nationalized them. And the long and the short of it was they gave Occidental Petroleum a deal that they could refuse, and they had to leave the country. So Occidental went back to Texas, and the Ecuadorians took over the oil production at Lago Agrio. And the pipeline still runs through the political capital, so there's no way that any of the various factions can control the oil without controlling the politics in the middle of Ecuador. Hmm. So the way this money trickles down is that it doesn't. You'll see a lot of very fine automobiles in the capital city running on streets that are still cobblestone, that are not being kept up. They would like to have good roads. They don't really care so much about good education, but good roads are good. But even that they can't pull off. They give money to the people that are supposed to build the roads, but all the way down there's a corruption that takes the money away to run somebody's, you know, just put into somebody's pocket. So very little of the money actually gets down to the, especially outside of the capital city. You ever see, you know, there's not much money for schools, no money for roads. They're in not in particular good shape for a country that really is quite wealthy. They have the natural resources to be wealthy. A lot of resources there. They've got a lot of oil mainly.
Did you ever feel unsafe when you were wandering around?
Oh, I don't know. I never, most of my travel, I've never really taken as many precautions as I should have. Safety and also for what I ate or drank, and it's kind of that what I've been eating or what I've been exposed to disease-wise is kind of catching up with me. I recommend that you be pretty careful about that. As far as safety goes, I think if you're traveling in a group and you're not too ostentatious, I think keep your cameras cheap. Don't take terribly expensive equipment along, and keep it in a knapsack or something that's kind of inconspicuous, something that's not. Don't go out there with your Gucci shoes and your fancy clothes, because then you might get in trouble. Also, there was some problems in the Mariscal Sucre, which is kind of a party part of town, and rich gringos had a tendency to get robbed in the middle of the night when they had been drinking too much. So if they went into the bars and came out drunk and they looked rich, then they could get in trouble if they left, if they tried to walk home or left the central area. My wife got pickpocketed when she was there. She lost her wallet too, by an entirely different method. She was paying a bus fare, and she pulled her wallet out of her knapsack, out of the bottom of her knapsack, and put it back into the bottom of her knapsack. But there was a group of thieves that saw that, and they got on the on the bus with her, and proceeded to kind of jostle her and bump her. And somebody in that group of thieves was really good, because he got into the bottom of the knapsack and took the wallet out without.
Did he cut off the bottom? So he just got into the knapsack.
This guy was good. She never even knew until an hour later that she'd been pickpocketed. And by that time, there were a couple of gas charges and some department store charges that had been run up on her Visa card. So she lost about $60, and then then we had to go through this production of getting our Visa card replaced. But to their credit, Visa made good. It was fraud, and they didn't charge us for the fraudulent use.
You never paid for the insurance they try to sell you on these fraudulent charges.
Never did. Okay. No, it's actually it's a difference between a credit and a debit card. A credit card, your maximum liability, even traveling overseas, is $50, and they didn't try to collect for those fraudulent charges. We lost our $60 of cash, and then the money that I lost to Mildred, and that was the worst of the crime that we saw in Ecuador. I guess you could say that was a pretty, I don't know, it happened to us, but I didn't worry about it much. I thought, well, that's
a cost of traveling, huh? Yeah,
pickpockets, they're good. They're very slick. I'd say take a money belt or a couple of credit cards. A couple of credit cards are good, and leave it at that. If you do get mugged, if you get accosted in the middle of the night, it's always good to have something to give the guy, and you're getting off cheap if you can just give him a wallet full of $50 or something like that, because then he's happy and you're not dead. So the deal about Ecuador and a lot of those South American crime deals is they're not really violent crime. They're more stealth and craftiness. You know, they're people that pickpockets or they'll deal crimes of opportunity.
Well, that was the first part of my interview with Bill. I'm going to be posting the second part of the interview when I get around to it. The next part of the interview, Bill talks about some of his travels in Peru and some adventures and experiences he had there, as well as a lot of the adventures he's had as an Alaska fisherman and how he got involved in that. So again, please contribute your stories either in written form or audio format or the call-in line. Join our group at www.traveltradeexchange, and I appreciate you listening.